Okay, here we are again with part three on day two, and probably the last part that I'm going to record for this core methods module. And we continue to talk about exercise number four, where we have a set with four elements. So just for now, we can call them 1, 2, 3, 4, just because it doesn't matter what names they have. And G is its full group of permutations, where the binary operation is composition. So G is really just the full permutation group on these numbers. In maths, we have standard notation for all this stuff. So if you want to look at books later, then you just look for a symmetric group and then you will find this. Now we fix an element from the set. So now M is the set and A is an element in M, so it's one of these numbers. And we look at the set of permutations fixing the element. And I wrote this down somewhere earlier on one of these papers. Now we check with the subgroup criterion, and you just told me that the identity map, which is, so 1G is the identity map, and it fixes A. So that's fine. So now for the subgroup criterion number two, what do we need? We need two such maps, and then we need to check what one of them times the inverse of the other does. So we take alpha, beta, in G index A, which is the set of permutations that have in common that they fix the point A. Right, so we have these two, and we want to look at A times beta in alpha times beta inverse, but the thing is that we don't really know anything about beta inverse, or do we? You thought about it. Can you tell us what you thought about with beta inverse?
So, beta has a property, since it is in the subset GA,
mm-hmm.
that it has to fix A.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the inverse of beta, composed with beta, is the identity.
Yes.
So it has to fix, it also fixes A. And
So we can basically take this equation and apply. So that we can use this. Which map do I have to apply to this equation so that I can use what you just said?
Beta minus one.
Beta inverse, exactly. So now I take this equation, and now I have that A to the beta inverse is the same as A mapped with beta inverse. Now the right hand side I just leave, but the left hand side can be now changed, because I know that if I apply beta and then beta inverse, I get mapped by the identity map. So I get A, which means that beta inverse also fixes A. Maybe you saw this in a different way. There are lots of ways how you can see that. But if a map fixes a point, then its inverse map has to fix the point as well because of bijectivity. Aha! And now, what do we need to check? How can we check whether alpha times beta inverse is also in this set, GA? What is the property we need to look at? Say it again?
Identity.
What do you mean?
The identity element should be the same as for the group.
Oh, but we are using the subgroup criterion. There we don't need to check that. We only need to check that the identity is in the set, which we already did. The identity fixes A. And now we are checking, if we take two elements, whether one times the inverse of the other is in there. And I was asking what I need to check for an element to be contained. So what is it? What do I need to check? What is the one property that these elements here have in common? They fix A. So this is what I need to check. So now I check A mapped with alpha times beta inverse. Exactly. So I do that. First I map A with alpha, then I map the result with beta inverse, and now we just use what we have. A mapped with alpha is
A.
A, because alpha is in the set GA. And now, together we just establish that A is fixed by beta inverse as well, which means that altogether we get A. And we're done. So that's how we prove with the subgroup criterion that G index A. So this thing is called a point stabilizer. It's the set of elements that fix a point, the point stabilizer of level A. This is actually a subgroup, which is great because now we can do group theory with point stabilizers. And it gives you lots of things that you don't have to calculate now. For example, if you're interested in the set of elements that fix three points, you just intersect their point stabilizers and you know it's a subgroup because we have proven points. Right? Now let's generalize this. Now instead of just four elements, 1 to 4, we take arbitrary finite sets, 1 to n, and instead of just fixing a point, we allow for sets of points to be either fixed point-wise or maybe stabilized as a set. So how can these ideas be generalized? Does it work? Does it get more complicated? What do you think? Permutations on M. M is the set I want to n, and n is some natural number. It can be really large. And now, how can I phrase that I want to generalize the idea of a point stabilizer? So instead of just fixing one point, and of course for one point it doesn't matter how big n is, the idea is always the same, right? But how can I make it more interesting instead of just fixing one point? How can I formalize this?
You can consider the all fixed points as one entity.
So should I take a subset, just a subset of M? Is that what you mean? Okay. How should I call it? What's the name of the subset?
W.
Let W be a subset of M. And now let's give a name to the subset of G that we're interested in, maybe H. Subset of G. And H is defined to be the set of group elements. And these are maps, so I'm going to stick with Greek letters for now. So it's the alpha in G such that, well, how do I describe that I want the set of points W to be stabilized somehow, left invariant? How can I say this?
We start with a random letter K, which will belong to, which K can be anything from 1 to N.
Yeah.
And then we apply the same thing, like,
but then it's just one point. How can I make this for several points? So what if W consists of several numbers?
So fixing several points, that is the...
Maybe. So this is one possibility. The way I wrote it, it could be that we just fix several elements at once, all of them individually, but as I said before, this would just be intersecting several point stabilizers. So this is, again, an interesting substructure, but it's not really new because we already know how point stabilizers work. So now we want to make it more interesting by not fixing all the points, but just having a set of points, and we want to sort of leave this alone. So it shouldn't be mapped elsewhere.
So we know that if we fix one point, it is a subgroup.
If we fix several, it's also a subgroup because we intersect them, and the intersection of subgroups is. Exactly. Now I want this to be a little bit more general. So let me give you an example. Maybe I did not make clear what my idea is. So here, for example, I could say that I want to fix 1 and 2. And if I fix 1 and 2, then I intersect the point stabilizer for 1 and the point stabilizer for 2, and I get a subgroup, and I know everything, and it's boring. But what if I allow for 1 and 2 to be fixed or interchanged? So the subset of numbers consisting of 1 and 2 is left alone, but I don't say that the points have to be both fixed. So this makes it more interesting, and I'm trying to find a way to write this together with you.
So what I was trying to say is, so let's say you want to fix n number of points?
Yes, but I don't want to say which ones. I don't want to say which ones. I want it to be arbitrary.
Yeah, so just n is random. It's number of points. Then you can consider n number of points as a single entity, and then you end up with n minus n, that's a capital N minus small n, number of numbers in your elements in M, and then you use the same logic as this.
Okay, so Sama, your approach is just different in the sense that you want to be precise and give names to the numbers. I don't want to do that because the numbers are just for simplification. Really, we talk about objects and there could be other things, and then we couldn't just give numbers to them.
Yeah, but there's still a finite way of doing this, right? So you can only, if you want n numbers to be fixed, you can only select in capital N, C, n number of ways.
Yes, but then where's W? In the description you just gave me, where's W?
W is a collection of these numbers or elements in the set M that
mm-hmm.
are kept fixed.
Okay, so for example, it could be the numbers 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
But it could also be the numbers
4, 5, 6.
N minus 4, N minus 3,
yeah,
N minus 2.
True.
Right. Okay.
But then you end up with a new set, M prime, for instance, that has N minus W number of elements.
That's the thing. I don't want to throw the numbers away. I want to keep everything in my sight. So I need to find a way that I'm still computing everything, but I'm stabilizing the set of numbers I'm interested in. So we need to have both. We
yeah,
shouldn't
so,
throw
so, so
in
you're not throwing the numbers away. You're essentially clubbing them together, calling that set W within the set M.
But how do I describe that I leave
okay,
the
that's,
alone? That's what I'm asking.
Such that
how do I describe that I leave these numbers alone?
The alpha applied to, let's say, small omega is in omega, big capital omega for all omega and omega. And I mean double.
What should I write here? For all omega in big W,
yes.
If I apply alpha to omega, what should happen?
Should be also in W.
Ah, okay. So I'm not saying that it's fixed. I'm just saying it's still in omega, in W. Right, so let's see. Is that what we want? Let's just look at it for a moment. Is that what we want?
Okay, a side question. Instead of intersection, do you mean you want the union of all these cells?
No, the union of subgroups is usually not a subgroup. What I mean is the following. Let me make it more precise by giving you an example and a non-example. Maybe this is helpful. Yes. And I'm glad that you keep asking. This is good. How do I want to begin this? So let's say n is 5. Possibility 1. Alpha fixes 1. 2 and 3. Possibility 2. Alpha maps 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 1. In the first case, 1, 2, and 3 are fixed, so alpha is in the stabilizer of 1, intersect stabilizer of 2, intersect stabilizer of 3,
yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
Here, the set 1, 2, 3 is not mapped somewhere else by alpha because the numbers all stay inside. But I'm not in the point stabilizers because 1 is mapped to 2, it's not fixed. 2 is mapped to 3, it's not fixed. So I'm also not in the union of anything, it's just. Where am I?
So yeah, exactly. The question was
where am I in the group? Can we give examples for group elements that do this? Do we have a group element in the permutation group on 1 to 5 that fixes 1, 2, and 3? Do you have examples for me?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 5, 4.
Let's take the notation that we agreed to use. So tell me where you want to map everything. So 1, 2, and 3 are fixed, and where do you want to map 4 and 5?
4, 5.
Ah, so this would be this.
Yeah.
1, 2, and 3 are not mentioned, so they're not moved, and 4 and 5 swap places. So this is an element that satisfies this, possibility 1. Very good, thank you. Now, for possibility 2, of course, this works, but it doesn't move 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 1. So it works on the other two numbers, it's allowed to do that, but it's not allowed to be this element because it moves these numbers in the wrong way. So how can I find a group element that does this? Do you have one for me?
Does this without changing 4 and 5?
You're allowed to change or not. It doesn't say anything about 4 and 5. That's the beauty of it. You have some freedom. What do you want to do?
Yeah, so 1, 2, 3.
Open
right.
Method.
Okay, that does it. So this element very clearly satisfies possibility 2. It does not satisfy possibility 1. This element satisfies possibility 1. It does not satisfy possibility 2. And here's an element that combines this action here and this, namely the element 1, 2, 3 combined with the element 4, 5. So this map does a 3 cycle here on 1, 2, 3, and it interchanges 4 and 5 at the same time. So this again satisfies possibility 2. That's a different element. So we see that we have a bit more room to maneuver here. I could also take the element. Just for now, let me stick with this. I don't want to go too far too quickly. So what I'm saying is, if I have to fix 1, 2, and 3, then the only room to maneuver I have for my maps is whether I move 4 and 5 or not. So there's only one possibility for a map that is not the identity. Whereas if I allow for movement in the set 1, 2, 3, then I have more options. This is one option, 1 goes to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 1. But I can do more things on the set. I can swap 1 and 2 and leave 3 alone. And I can always combine it with interchanging 4 and 5 or not. Which means that if I allow for these numbers to move, I have many, many more maps. Therefore, the set of maps that sort of respect this set without restrictions is much bigger than the set of maps that fix 1, 2, and 3, each of them. So this is the distinction I want to make. In this case, I also respect the set, but I have to fix every point. And here, I respect the set, but I'm allowed to. So they can have a party. Like they don't have to stand still, they can move and dance around. Right? It's like, suppose you have a basket of apples. And you can leave this basket of apples. One way is that each apple has to stay where it is, and the other way is that the apples can be moved around, so I can shake it, and they can go to another place. So that's the difference. And now we have seen in this example, and this is true in general, as soon as the set that we respect has size 2 or more, we get strictly more possibilities if we only respect the set rather than fixing all the numbers. So it gives us more possibilities. And I just want to give you more and more ideas to define substructures of big groups so that you can find smaller groups. Let's go back. So now we have seen what such a subset W can look like. So over there, the set would be 1, 2, 3. That would be W. And we have seen that rather than fixing all the points in W, we just want to say that they have to be moved inside the set. The set should be respected. You're not allowed to take a point and map it outside. This is weaker. And the question is whether this property is strong enough so that we get a subgroup, because it's a weaker property than fixing all the points. Right? And if a property looks a bit weaker, then sometimes it's not clear that we get a subgroup in this way. So we should check. SG1, what do you think? Does the identity map satisfy what you need to be in H? Yes. Yes, because all the points are mapped to themselves, they stay in W, nothing exciting happens. For all W in W, the identity fixes them. So that's fine. And now for SG2, maybe we can try a similar argument to just before when we started the exercise. So let alpha beta in H. And let's begin by understanding what beta inverse does, just as before. So before, we took the point A and we saw that if beta fixes it, then its inverse map beta inverse also has to fix it. But here, we don't have one point little a, we have lots of points, and we don't really know what beta does. But we do know that the images have to stay inside the set. What is your idea?
No.
Question?
This set that we are talking about, it corresponds to possibility 2.
Yes, so this would be, W is the set 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, and you are allowed
and
to,
you're allowed to move them around. So this corresponds to possibility 2.
Yeah, and this is not the same as what we want in this question. I mean, I'm just clarifying if we are on the same page.
What do you mean with this situation?
I mean, in the question 4.
I'm generalizing the question.
Yeah, generalizing. So for generalizing, we need possibility 1, right?
Well, when I said what happens if you fix several elements at once, that would be possibility 1.
Yes.
This would be intersecting points level.
Exactly.
We are past that.
We are past that.
So now I say individually or as a set.
Yeah.
That's possibility 2.
Got it.
Yeah. Thank you. No, it's good. No, you have to ask and clarify. This is good. It's always good. Thank you. And we have a feeling now that it's not the same. So I'm asking individually, as I said, is it the same? And we get a feeling no. But I did not ask you whether you even get a subgroup. So let's just check that we really get a subgroup,
yeah.
Just because it might be interesting for you, for your work, to find subgroups in this way. So the way we did it before, we had a point A, and it was fixed by beta, and therefore it was also fixed by beta inverse. Now we don't have such a strong property, so what do we do? So somehow we need an element from W, and we need beta inverse.
We know that beta inverse exists.
Yes, because all these elements are permutations, they're all bijective. Yes,
yeah.
Thank you. We know that beta inverse exists. Mm-hmm. So we know that beta inverse exists in the big group G.
Yeah.
This we know. So we can work with it.
Yeah, we want to check if it also belongs to H.
Exactly. So we have to check what it does with elements from W.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So same as before, no?
Maybe, we can try. So if we take omega of W from W, who started saying omega? From W, it also looks like a little omega. So now, this is in W, and then we know that beta maps it to something in W, and the question is whether we can write every element in W as an image under beta. Can we?
Can you repeat what you said?
So before, when we said that beta fixes A, it meant that A is the same as A mapped by beta, or in other words, it was possible to write A as the image of something under beta, which is true for all permutations because they are surjective. And now my question is it possible to write an element of W as an image under beta from something in W?
It will belong to W, that's all we know. That is where it's different from the first case, because in the first case we knew that it was the same element.
It was the same element, and now we only know it's in W. Exactly. So it could be something else, but in W. And I'm trying to focus your attention to what happens if we restrict the map beta to W. What happens? Because we know that everything, all the images, are again in W. So we could consider the restriction of beta to W as a permutation of the set W. Everything in there is moved around. We don't even see the other points. They don't play a role for now. So we can, for a moment, look at the restriction of what beta does on omega, on W. And then, it's still a bijective map, which means that if we take a point in W, then it can be written as the image of something under beta from W.
But this is because we are working with finite sets, right?
No, I think it's always true if you restrict to a subset and you. So, oh, you mean this? Yeah. In if
you
it was infinite, then I would write this differently, and I would say that W is mapped, is bijectively mapped onto itself by alpha. That's slightly different than this, but in the finite setting, that's yes. Thank you. Thank you. Good point. Between finite and infinite world. Yes. So here, since W is finite, this condition we wrote here is the same as saying that if we restrict elements in H to W, then we get a bijection or a permutation of the set W. That's one way to do it. So there are several ways how we can argue here, but what we need is a generalization of the argument from before. So we definitely need an idea here how to generalize it. And my idea would be to say, then there exists X in W such that X beta is W, because the restriction of beta to W is a permutation of W. And then if I map now W by beta inverse, then it's the same as mapping X beta, and then these two together get the identity, so we get X, which is in W. So this is one way of doing it. There are other ways. But then the idea after that is the same as before. So now that we have that the inverse of beta is also in H, we can then combine alpha and beta inverse, and with the same argument as before, we get that everything from W is mapped inside W again by the composition. Which means that we can, so we just have to think a bit harder, but we can generalize the idea of a point stabilizer to a set stabilizer. And the same idea transfers, so it goes even further. So if you have a set of objects, and one to n are just numbers, but they could be numbers that come up in lists in computer code. They could be numbers like vertices of graphs. They could be vertices in some geometrical structure. They could be, I don't know. And if you see some symmetry in your picture, and if you want to stabilize something, for example, a part of the graph, or maybe some letters that you see, or whatever, then it will be stabilizing a subset, which means that you run into these groups automatically and very naturally. Therefore, it's worth talking about them for a few minutes. Right? And then, depending on what substructure you have, maybe there is more that you fix, maybe there is more structure that needs to be respected, and then maybe your subgroup becomes even smaller. That's the idea. That was exercise number four. Actually, we went beyond exercise number four, which is good. We talked a little bit about 5 already. We had a nice counter sample, so we cannot replace SG2 by just being closed. What about lemma 3.1? So I ask here in exercise 6, in the corrected version where the numbers are correct, so it's lemma 3.1 with the two points that are next to each other, and we prove that this is enough to understand what a symmetry does if we understand it on two neighboring points. And my question is whether we really need that they are neighboring points. Maybe there is a weaker property that would be sufficient. Hi, Stuart. So what do you think? Can we maybe make this property a little bit weaker? Maybe any two points, or maybe they don't necessarily have to be neighbors,
yeah,
maybe it's something else.
I think nearest is the best case, but because if you have two arbitrary points, then you can come up with several situations where you don't restrict the distance.
Yes, but do you have an example? Do you have an example where it goes wrong? Maybe you just need a more clever argument. Maybe
disordered polygon.
If it's wrong, then we need an example.
A square could be example.
A square. Okay, let's try. Maybe together you can come up with a specific example. Let's draw a square. If we had the transfer point square, that would be nice because it's small, which tells us that really there is some principal thing going wrong. What about markers? Oh yeah, I keep carrying them around with me. That's not good. They should stay in place. Right, so we have a square. And now you tell me that you can take two points and symmetries and the same images, but the symmetries are not the same if they're not neighbors. Do you have what was your idea first? Does it work in a square? The idea that you have? So you wanted to take something with a distance that is bigger?
Yeah, so my point was if you could just consider points 1 and 3 or 2 and 4.
Let's take 1 and 3 and let's take a map. Let's call it sigma. And 1 sigma is the same, sorry, 2 maps, sigma and tau. 1 sigma is the same as 1 tau and 3 sigma is the same as 3 tau. So do you have examples for maps tau and sigma that are not the same?
Well, it's more from some sort of an intuition that there is nothing constraining point 2. We're just talking about 1 and 3.
Why not? It's a neighbor of 1 and 3. So if we have information.
Yeah, but we thought of.
I'm just challenging your intuition.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's wrong, I'm just challenging your intuition.
Yeah, sure, but I think the premise of this argument was that they don't have to be neighbors, so there is no criterion on neighboring points. So
you're saying somehow this information is too weak because,
yeah,
two and four
have
the same
have
relationship
no,
to 1 and 3 somehow.
I mean, there is no symmetry constraining 2 and 4. I can fix 1 and 3 and then make it a rhombus and it still probably is valid.
You cannot change the square into a non-square. That's not allowed. It has to stay a square. But how can the numbers 2 and 4 move? Do you find two different possibilities for them to move? That's the question.
Oh, okay.
So the question is whether it's possible for two different maps to map 1 and 3 in the same way. And I'm not even saying that they have to be fixed. They can move around, they just have to move in the same way. And I have not yet seen an example, so I'm not convinced.
Let's say that 1 and 3 switch, interchange.
Okay, so you want to say the maps map 1 to 3 and 3 to 1.
Yes.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. So they swap places, and swapping suggests a reflection, but maybe there's another way.
Yeah, so we can, then we have two cases for 2 and 4. They can stay or they can move.
Okay, can you explain this in more detail?
So
two
can draw
two stays and four stays?
Yes.
What would the map be?
That would be a reflection. Reflection through with the axis through 2 and 4.
Ah, okay, so you're suggesting that sigma could be possibility 1, so 2 and 4 would stay, and then this would be the reflection with the line here, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
So these change places. Okay, I see, this works.
Mm-hmm.
So sigma could be the reflection going through 2, let's say. Okay, and then you said there is a second case. What could the second case be?
That would be that 2 and 4 also change places.
Uh-huh, okay.
And then that would correspond to tau being a rotation sub 2, so 180 degrees.
So that would be the rotation 2, I think?
Yeah.
Where everything moves 2 places further? Right, okay, let's see what we have here. We found a map sigma that maps 1 to 3 and 3 to 1, and 2 and 4 are fixed. And we have a name for this map, it's the reflection with reflection axis through 2 and 4. So we only care about how it maps 1 and 3, so these are interchanged. Okay. And then we found a map tau that does the same, 1 and 3 are interchanged, but in this case 2 and 4 move differently because they are also interchanged, which means that we found a counterexample to a more general version of lemma 3.1. So if in lemma 3.1 we remove that the points are neighbors, and if we just say 2 points, and if they are not the same way, then the maps are the same, then this would be a counterexample, because 1 and 3 are mapped in the same way, but the other 2 points are not. This is a really small counterexample. It's actually also the first one that came to my mind when I thought about it. And so the reason, so I tried to follow your intuition first, and the reason why I did not follow further was that we did not make it precise. And the thing with counterexamples is that sometimes you have an intuition that something goes wrong, but then if you don't follow up and make it precise, then maybe your intuition just plays tricks on you and you just need a different argument, but it still works. Whereas here in this case, we tried to really start with precise numbers and images, and we really looked for different possibilities to make it precise. And that's what a precise counterexample looks like, or how you can get there. So somehow it's a continuation of the intuition starting with precise images. And it could have happened that our intuition here tells us, oh, I'm sure something goes wrong, but then maybe it works because the square is too small. It could have happened that counterexamples only occur with bigger n1s, in which case, hopefully, at some point we would have noticed, and then we would have said, ah, okay, for larger n1s, we find arguments, but maybe for very small ones, we can find a generalization of a lemma. Turns out, no. So for triangles, it doesn't make sense because any 2 points are neighbors. The square is the smallest one where you can find things that are not neighbors, and it immediately goes wrong. So we really cannot generalize this lemma in that direction. Maybe in another direction. And if your structures are more complex, and maybe you have different versions of what neighbor could mean or what distance could give you as information, then maybe you can try and prove versions of the lemma that look differently for your situation. Okay, so I'm just trying to explain why I wanted this to be precise. Okay, thank you for discussing this with me. And now let's talk about something three-dimensional. Maybe you remember in the beginning we talked about permutations of the set 1, 2, 3, and then we saw that for a triangle you can find all these permutations as symmetries of the triangle, and for the square this did not work because we have so many more permutations of the set 1, 2, 3, 4 than symmetries of the quadrangle square. Now from our theorem we know how many. We know it's 8. Four rotations and four reflections, as opposed to 24 elements that we get if we take all permutations of the set 1, 2, 3, 4. Here I have another object with numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and I want to find out together with you how many and which permutations of the set 1, 2, 3, 4 can be viewed as symmetries of this object. So by symmetry, again, I mean a bijective map of this object to itself, that's distance preserving, which means that the corners have to be mapped to corners, sides to sides, faces to faces, blah, 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 but they can move around. So maybe let's begin with some examples for symmetries. Can you tell me examples for symmetries of this object? What can I do?
3-fold rotation.
Say it again.
3-fold rotation.
3-fold rotation. So for rotation, I need an axis. Yes. So
I'm cutting the centroid of each triangle.
So for example, I can fix 4.
Yeah, fix 4.
Yes, so it was just your hand.
Okay.
So fix 4. So I pretend I'm standing at the top, I'm number 4, and there's the tetrahedron below me, and then I can see the numbers 1, 2, 3 next to me, and they can turn around in the circle. That's exactly what you mean, right? Exactly. Yeah, and it's threefold, meaning that if you go around 3 times, then you have the identity. And can we maybe write this as a permutation of the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4 in the way we did before? Because 4 is fixed and the others move, so maybe you can tell me what it looks like. Rotation with fixed point 4, let's write. Rotation. I think the other pen is better for this. So rotation for is fixed. So what are the possibilities for such rotation if you move the numbers 1, 2, 3 and 4, 6 and you have to respect the structure of the tetrahedron? How does it work?
Same as the triangle.
Same as the triangle? So what should I write? Where does 1 go?
1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 3 and bracket goes.
Okay, and 4 is fixed. Can I also move 1 to 3 and 3? Yeah, so I can have the other one too? This one? Okay. And what happens if... So is there another possibility? So we're talking about rotations now. But just for a minute, let's suppose again I'm standing here, I'm number 4, and the others are there below me. Is there something else I can do besides rotating? What do you think?
Reflection.
How can I make a reflection happen?
If you fix the point 4.
So the reflection axis has to go through me. Gesundheit. Bless you. Okay, so I'm fixed because 4 is fixed, but where does the reflection axis, or maybe it's a plane rather?
It also crosses
1.
It also crosses one of the points below me, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And is everything possible? I mean, how does it work? So the reflection plane goes from here down, but where exactly does it go? How do I know?
It goes through 4 and 1 and also the middle of 2 and 3.
So okay. So it kind of cuts through here.
Yeah.
In the middle here,
yeah.
This is where it goes. So this means that 1 and 4 would be fixed, and
yeah.
What happens to these two numbers?
Interchange.
They interchange. Aha, okay. So reflections. And again, I'm fixing 4. So we say in our rotation it would be this. 2 and 3 are interchanged. Aha, interesting. So now let's keep this picture with 4 being fixed. What are the other possibilities for the reflection type?
1, 2, and 1, 3.
1, 2, and 1, 3. Aha. Depending on where the plane goes. So if it goes through 2, I interchange 1 and 3, and if it goes through 3, I interchange 1 and 2. Okay, interesting. So together with the identity map, we already found 6 very interesting maps just by fixing 4. So there is a principle here. Maybe you remember how very, very much earlier today, when we classified the symmetries of the regular N1, we started by saying 1 goes to some point K, and now we turn it back with a symmetry we know, so that we can now study symmetries that fix 1. This is what you have intuitively done here. You fixed the point, and then you looked at what can happen when that point is fixed. Yeah, that's great. I'm very proud. Good. Now, do you expect the situation to be different if we fix a different point? No, it's just perspective, right? So if I'm sitting here, if I'm 1 and I'm looking there, it looks the same, or I can sit over there at 2 or 3, and I get the identity, of course, but then I get always 5 interesting possibilities for symmetries, namely 2 different rotations that are not boring and 3 reflections. So let's count 4 corners that could be fixed times 5 interesting maps, and they are not the same because the fixed point profile is different. So we already found, if I'm not wrong, I think we found 20 maps, right? Plus 1, plus identity. Is that correct? Aha, that's a lot, because if you remember, we have 24 possibilities to swap the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and already 21 of them give symmetries of the tetrahedron. That's great. Maybe we can find all of them. What do you think? Do you have any more ideas for symmetries? Where do we have to look? If there is more, where do we have to look? Or how should we look at it? What needs to change?
How should be rotation, how should be reflection, so I think.
Do we know?
It's
Do we know?
That's yeah, the theorem, no?
Regular N1, this is not a regular N1. No, I mean, of course, it's good to think about, do we know anything, what is missing, but this is not a regular N1, and therefore we don't know. Maybe there's something else going on, something weird. Of course, we have many reflections already, right? So we already found 12 of them. So if the number in the end is 24, then it would even be true that half of them are reflections, but we don't know about the rest and the rotations. And it might be different in 3D. Did you look at the pictures? Maybe the pictures help to get some more ideas. Maybe we can start by discussing where the pictures correspond to the ideas that you just had together with me, because we already found so much. So here in the pictures, I hope it's big enough for you to see. Is it okay? Is it big enough? So where in the pictures do you see something that we have already discovered? It looks different. The tetrahedron is drawn from a slightly different perspective, but again, we have 1, 2, 3 at the bottom, and we have the point number 4 at the top, so that's the same. And do you recognize anything there?
I think the first one is reflections, like 2, 4, like this, 2, 3, 1.
Yes, they are different from the reflections that we have found, because they have no fixed points, right?
Oh, yes.
So let's keep this in mind for later. So this is something we have not discussed, because they have no fixed points. And everything we have discussed so far always had a fixed point. So what else do you see? What do you recognize?
B1.
What is B1?
It's going through 4. It's a
rotation.
That's a rotation axis. Yes, it goes through 4 and it goes through the middle here. Ah, so B1 is responsible for the first two things we found. Yes, very good. What else do you see? What about the other bees? Do you recognize the other bees? And let's move to the E's afterwards, just a second.
Yeah, B2, B3.
What about the other bees?
I mean, all four down and rotation axis, yeah.
Okay, so we understand the second picture, we understand the bees, they are responsible for these three cycles, so to speak, so for the rotation. Okay, excellent. So, first picture in a minute, second picture fully understood. Third picture? You wanted to say something about the E's, right? You too?
These are the planes for the reflections.
These are the planes for the reflections that we already found. Okay, the ones with the fixed points.
Yeah.
Excellent. Now let's stare at picture number 1.
Yeah, I know it.
You know? Okay, Chairman.
1, 4 bracket close, 2, 3 bracket. Like the line bisecting 1, 4 and also bisecting 2, 3. And you...
This?
Yes.
Okay, let's look at this. So somehow I need a line that goes through the middle here,
yeah,
so that these two are interchanged, and then it needs to go through the middle here,
yes,
so that these two are interchanged.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. That's another interesting reflection. And we have more of this type,
yeah,
don't we? What are the others?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Mm-hmm.
1, 3, 2, 4.
Mm-hmm. Three more elements. We already had 21, so that's it, because 24 was the upper bound. So, do you see? We found an object such that all the permutations of the set 1 to 4 can be viewed as symmetries of this object. And this is so much fun. So if you have a group, and if you want to study the group further, sometimes you're lucky and you find a geometric object or a graph or whatever, such that all the group elements can be made visible as symmetries of that object. And sometimes it gives you new insights. So this was just one example. And you did it so quickly. I'm really impressed that you saw all this really, really quickly. And you can do this for the cube. You can do it for more complex structures. And the idea is always the same. Fix a point. Understand what happens if you fix a point. Understand how much information you need in order to describe the map, and then look, okay, what happens if we don't fix a point? And this way you can begin to understand such a group. This is what this example was for.
Is there a name for the for for their last kind of operation.
Yeah. In group theory speech, this is the three cycle because we turn three numbers around in a circle. This is the two cycle or transposition, and you have cycles of arbitrary length if you have enough numbers, but the numbers have to be pairwise distinct for this name to work. This is a double transposition. This is what we call it when we have two cycles with disjoint domains where, so element conjoint. So these are double transpositions, and then you can have threefold transpositions, fourfold, blah, 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 blah. And what happens if you study this further? Sorry, only 2 minutes, but I think I want to take this question as motivation for that. So if you have the set 1 to n, and if you have all permutations on it, then this gives rise to a group that is called, well, there are several names, but there are some standard names. So my name is this, sum index n. Some people say sum in brackets n. And the other two standard notations that I have found are S index n or big sigma index n. So this is mine, and the others are also fairly standard. Depends on the books that you like. So this gives a group. And then, you, as we have seen here together, you always have this kind of standard way how you can write what the maps do with these cycles. And sometimes you need one cycle, and sometimes you need several. But there's always a way how you can write down these permutations, which classifies them according to something that we say is a cycle type. So for example, here the cycle type would be 3, because you only have 1 3 cycle. If you have one of those and then another one, and the numbers are completely disjoint from one another, then you would say that the type is 3 3, because you have 2 3 cycles next to each other, no intersection. This would be type 2 2, for example. And there are versions how to write this. I'm just saying this now, I'm not writing this, so I don't have to introduce notation. And then, for example, you could have cycle type 2 5. You could have something like this, 1 2, and then 4 5 6 7 8. If n is big enough, it fits in there, and then you have cycle type 2 5. And the cycle type is very interesting because it classifies the element and it tells you how often you have to repeat doing the map until you reach identity. So here, if you repeat it once, two times, three times, then you get the identity because it's a three cycle. So threefold is what you said earlier, a threefold rotation. And here you have reflections. They always have, so in group theory speech we say order. So they have order 2, which means you apply them twice, you get the identity, but they are not the identity themselves. And here again, if you apply them twice, you get the identity. Here you have to apply this 10 times. So the cycle type tells you, you have to apply it 10 times until you get the identity, not before, because 10 is the lowest common multiple of 2 and 5. So if you start studying these groups, then you can really write down lots and lots of things that you can just see from the cycle type, and then there's a lot of very interesting theory going on. One of the reasons why we are so interested in these groups is that very often they are the universe where things happen. So very often in applications, the big universe where everything happens will be such a gigantic symmetric group, and then if you're lucky, your actual problem happens in a smaller subgroup, and then you can start studying it. Okay, let me check the time. More questions?
The time is there.
The time is there? Oh, yes, it's on the screen. That's true. Yeah, that's true. It's 2 o'clock. Let us go back to the exercises once more, unless you have more questions now directly. For that? Okay, I don't see any. Then let's see what the remaining exercises are. And then we can make a plan for the remaining time that we have. Okay, so we discussed everything up to exercise 6. Now we have exercise number 7, which was the first part of the lemma. And you have basically seen what was going on there. So I don't know, has anyone already thought about this exercise? Number 7? A little bit maybe, okay? And then we have number 8, where we have specific questions about regular n-gons and their symmetry groups. So for example, we have questions about what changes if n is even or odd and things like that. So this is a little bit more advanced, and given that we only started talking about this today, I'm not sure who already did something there. So it will be up to you later and how much detail we discuss this here together. So you can always say, I started thinking about this and I want to keep thinking about it. I don't want to know the answer yet, so I will not stay for the discussion. So there will be an open-ended bit in the end where I talk about solutions only to those who want to discuss them, not for those who want to go and try themselves. And the open bit will also be about other questions, things that lead, I don't know, further somewhere, maybe related to your own interests. Which means that now we can see what other questions you have. So we have covered quite a bit of ground. We have done some very formal introduction, very mathematical, with tiny steps. What is a group? What are some examples, counterexamples? Hopefully you got some inspiration where this might touch your own work. We looked at substructures. We looked at some strategies, how we can understand and classify groups. What questions came up during this time? What is there that you would like to know more about?
Can you discuss topology in terms of group theory, like how these two fields are connected?
That depends on what you mean by topological, because I have a feeling that several people mean several different things with that word.
I mean it in a mathematical sense. If you have, for example, so for example, in band structures, if you take a Brillouin zone and you integrate over the Fermi surface, so the integration of the Fermi surface is quantized in certain Brillouin zones, and it doesn't matter.
This is not what I learned about topology. That's what I meant. I think you mean something different with the word than I mean. So for me, topology comes from topological spaces. So this has to do with open and closed sets, and that doesn't seem to be what you talk about.
Yeah.
So what is what? Have you a definition for me? What topology is, or
so? So in physics, of topological physics, like we have some kind of topological invariance. For example, there's a thing called Chern number, which you might know better than me.
Okay, maybe I can
What is topology? I have absolutely no idea what it means for you.
So, for example,
there's a way of treating poles and some singularities in a function that you may come across.
Singularities.
Yeah, so it's like essentially solving contour integrals in the spirit of residue theorem or Cauchy integral.
Would it be something like the genus for Riemann
yeah.
surfaces?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
But then what is the topology?
The value, is it one genesis or two genesis, number of poles in a...
Ah, so would you say that two things with the same genus as Riemann surface have the same topology?
Exactly.
Right. Okay, that's very unusual for me to use this word, but okay. Keep going. So where does symmetry... I mean, I see where symmetry plays a role for Riemann surfaces, obviously, but where does it touch your work? What is the context?
So I think, I don't know if you can say it better, but so if you have a certain class, like for example, a certain group which has same kind of symmetries and they are kind of classified in a similar topological class. I don't know.
What do you mean by class?
For example, this...
you mean like, for example,
Yeah, exactly. Number of holes in a
tree.
And these holes can be a characteristic of different materials which have some property of their band structure or symmetry.
This
leads to this one hole. They might be like different. Yeah, that's how it
works. I see. Okay. So I think we learned that my answer to your original question was no.
Yeah.
I cannot talk about this topic because I don't know what some of the words mean, but it seems as if you see a connection, which is good. I mean, obviously, there are some symmetry arguments that might be relevant, and
yes.
I'm sure you have groups of transformations that you look for these objects. Yes. So I can see the relevance, and no, I cannot talk about this more just because I don't. I would have to read what all the words mean.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Nice.
I've seen this happen before, so it happens quite often that there are words that are used in other areas, and then I think, oh, this is something I know, and then 2 seconds later I think, no, I have no idea. It's just the same.
Word. My fault was that I didn't went deep into these topics. How really these are connected. It was kind of a lazy attempt to get some knowledge.
What else?
Maybe I can add to that. Maybe I'm also not. There is a general classification of what kind of topological indices you can get depending on your system and your symmetry. So when there are certain symmetries, then they are predicted that you have certain topological indices, for example, which can only take two values.
I see.
Which is called C2 index. And there is another, the term number, what you mentioned is the Z index, so you can take any integer number.
Yes.
And I think this, the mathematical background is somehow homotopy groups.
Maybe. So to me it sounds like differential geometry.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Thank you. Nothing else right now? Okay. Then...
Could you talk about factor group if we have the time? Because I think in physics it appears at some... all the time, also especially Hilbert spaces. The L2 space is also defined as a factor group.
Yes. For a factor group, you need... two ingredients. You need first of all you have a group you start with. Let's call this G again, G and dot. And then you need a normal, a so-called normal subgroup. So I'm just using the subgroup sign and then I'm closing it with this little triangle. And a normal subgroup is a subgroup that has a special additional quality. The additional quality is the following. For all A and N and G and G, the following holds. If I take A and if I multiply it from the left with G inverse and from the right with G, and I don't put brackets because of the associativity law, then again I end up in N. So it's somehow like a closure property, but it's not being closed under the binary operation, it's being closed under this weird operation here, where an element comes from the left, inverted, and then from the right, original, and you shouldn't leave the subgroup if you do that. So this kind of mapping is called conjugation. It's a very important concept in finite, well, general in group theory. I know it from finite group theory. And subgroups that are invariant under this kind of operation are called normal subgroups. And normal subgroups allow for factor structures to be built, and I build it in the following way. So G mod N is defined to be the set of so-called cosets of N, which means it's a set of sets. I take everything that is an N and I multiply it by G, and then I get a new set, and this is the collection of all these sets, but the thing here, the G I multiply with, is fix every time. It's called a representing element, for example. So I get this, and usually this is just an interesting set of subsets, and it gives a partition of the group, and you can, for each group element, you can say where it lands and so on, and this happens a lot with equivalence relations, and you get this naturally. But for a normal subgroup, something special happens. You can build a new group with these guys. So now you can form a new group with new binary operation, and I call it box. Now I take two of these, color, n times A and n times B, and I have to say what happens when I box them, right? So that's my new binary operation. This is defined to be what happens if I take again one of these, but as a representing element, I now take the product of A and B. Here's the thing. When I do this calculation, so when I box, I choose A and I choose B and I form their product for this new guy here. But the thing is, I have choices for A and B because this is just a set. And instead of G representing it, there are other possibilities for elements representing the same guy. Which means that here, when I box, I have to make a decision. Which A do I choose? Which B do I choose? And then I multiply them, and then all hell could break loose because maybe, depending on the choices here, I get different results. And then this wouldn't be a binary operation because a binary operation is a map. And if I have choices for my images, it's not a map. So this is where this funny normal subgroup property comes into the picture. I will not do the calculations. This would be a different cost. But this is where it goes wrong, usually, for subgroups. But it works like magic for normal subgroups, which is why they enter the group theory world and they give rise to new groups. And the thing is that you can calculate all sorts of stuff here. So for example, if we take all permutations on the set 1 to 4, and if we only take the ones like the three cycles and the double transpositions, then they form a very special subset, subgroup, in fact, with 12 elements. And this is a normal subgroup. So if the full group of permutations is called G, and if the subgroup with 12 elements I talked about is called N, and it's normal, then I can look at the factor group, the section, G mod N. This is what we call it, G mod N, modulo N. And in finite group land, I can do calculations now. If I know that my big group has 24 elements, and the normal subgroup has 12 elements, then the factor group has 2 elements, for example. So I can do math with that. And I can also find out things about the structure. So some group properties will be inherited by sections, and some not, and vice versa. Sometimes I have a nice property here, and I can lift it and find a property of G and so on. But this is subtle, in particular because there are some subtleties involved here in order to get there. But once you have this concept, you can use it to sometimes break up a big group into smaller pieces and study them, and then maybe retract the information to your big group. So it's just one bit from your toolkit. Yeah.
Is there a way to construct this normal subgroup if you have these permutations? And how do you define N then?
N is the set of even permutations. So if you distinguish between even and odd permutations by number of transpositions, you need to write them down as a product of transpositions. So for, let me put it differently. For cycles, if the length is odd, then the permutation is even. So three cycles are even, four cycles are odd. And for these multiple transpositions, if the elements are pairwise disjoint, the ones that you move, then you just count whether you have an even or an odd number. And this is how here in SIM 4 you can distinguish. So you have the four cycles, they are outside. You have the two cycles, they are outside. And everything else is in this normal subgroup. And this is a general construction that you can always do. And you find it under the name alternating group,
And in fact, in this situation, something special happens, because usually, so the big alternating groups are already simple building blocks, you cannot split them up further. But this one is so small that you can split it up further, because the, so for the tetrahedron, maybe you remember that the three cycles corresponded to rotations with one fixed point, and the double transpositions corresponded to reflections with no fixed points. And in fact, these three reflections with no fixed points, together with the identity map, give another normal subgroup inside this N, so you can make another section. So you can split the group up into a little piece of order 4, and then there is a section of order 3, and then another section of order 2. So this is how you can start investigating specific groups by looking at normal subgroups. If you find them, there are also some recipes how you can create normal subgroups. The thing is that normal subgroups, so if you start creating them, then sometimes you have no control over their size. So it could be that by accident you just create the trivial group or the whole group, and then you don't find anything interesting. But sometimes you are lucky and you find normal subgroups that sit somewhere in between, so you can actually split it up and you get two smaller pieces. Induction arguments very often work like this. In finite group theory, very often you can work with induction. You find a normal subgroup, you split it up into two smaller pieces, and then work from there, for example. That's how we use
it. Does this conjugation have an intuitive interpretation? It looks a bit like a coordinate transformation.
Yeah, that's one example. So when you do basis change in linear algebra, for example, that's an example for conjugation in invertible matrix land. Yeah. Exactly. That's one of the applications. If you study it abstractly, then you're always using that this kind of map gives you basically a symmetry of the group itself, meaning that you have a bijection and it respects the group structure. So we call this automorphism. And you can use it to study the group and to study the subgroup structure. And then there will be elements where this map doesn't do anything, so they will commute with everything else, and this gives an interesting subgroup. This is where group theory starts. It starts with the conjugation map and with everything that is. I think that's my very narrow view, but I think that a lot of very interesting group theory starts there. Maybe base change is one of the earliest, nicest examples. Okay, that was a little detour to sections. Anything else? For now? So I'm happy to answer more. I mean, that's why I'm here, right? This is my time for you to answer questions. We can have a little break so you can think about more things you might want to discuss. So how about 10 minutes, just so that we can get tea and coffee. I definitely want to get something from the machine. And then we meet again here. And then you decide. I will switch the audio off then for the last part. So for the last part, it's absolutely your decision. If you want to ask more advanced questions, ask more about the final exercises, or ask me anything, whatever, then you can. Just stay, and I will stay here as long as we have interesting things to talk about. If you say, that's fine, I learned enough about groups for this week, then just go home and thank you so much for coming. I had such an interesting time with you, and thank you for your many, many great questions and comments. I really, really enjoyed it. Is that okay for you as a plan? Okay, then see you in a moment.
Yeah. Should I sing songs?